Welcome now to LMFM. That's Leland Mullen FM here on the Phantom Podcast Network FM. Stereo for your ears there, folks, as we look at one of the greatest when it comes to rock and roll with attitude, soul, and music to your ears. Some of the only Eddie and the Cruisers. I'm the Leland Mullen. G'day, mate. Done it just yours. Sets, don't adjust your radios. You are listening to them on the only Lethal Mullet podcast live on Lethal Mullet Network and, of course, FPN. If you'll catch it a week later, episode number 92. And I'm your host, Adam O'Brien. Coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, where we enjoy all action movie fandoms, folks. That's right. So tonight we're going to be looking at something different. It's not an action movie, but it's certainly part of 80s culture, 80s rock and roll, 80s cult movie status as well, because it wasn't a huge success until it got onto cable and, of course, VHS. We're talking about Eddie and the Cruisers and the sequel, Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives. This is a really fun, lot of movies. It introduced the world really to Michael Paré after coming off TV and into feature films with, obviously, the Philadelphia Experiment, this film, and then later, of course, my favourite, Moon 44. But he's done a lot of work since, and he's definitely one of the cool actors out there. And, of course, we had Tom Berenger in there as well, and many others who we're going to go through, because even some of the lesser-known actors are great in this, particularly talking about the history of it, the two settings, the 60s and the 80s in it as well, and much more. So we can look at that very, very soon here on the show. All I can tell you is I'm excited because not only do I have them films now, and have watched them. I've also been going through, obviously, too, the great stuff we've seen on the LP as well, which we'll talk about the music, because the music is a big part of it, folks. G'day, Marnie Gowan. Follow the Lethal Mullet here on Phantom Podcast Network's master channel at fbnet.podbean.com or subscribe on the Podbean app where you can find all the shows. Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. Culture Clash, a weekly look at pop culture. New look at Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast. And also check out The Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe from me, the Lethal Mullet. You can also check out this show and all the others like What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast. Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, and much, much more. All on FPN. You can follow on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and all podcatchers. Make sure you follow me, The Lethal Mullet, at The Lethal Mullet on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Now it's time for the latest action news from the cinema and martial arts movies and more, all here on The Lethal Mullet Podcast. All right, lots to talk about, folks, and one of the big ones is an action movie that's 4 hours long, and I know you've all listened to the previous episode with my rundown and review of it. That is, of course, Zack Snyder's amazing opus, The Justice League. That's right, his own Justice League. It's his movie, folks. That's right. Joss Whedon's one he put out was an assembly of stuff that we want to forget now. But this film that has come out has not only ignited the passion of people that not only, first of all, didn't like the Joss Whedon cut, but also have a renewed faith in Snyder's vision. Snyder showed us some stuff in there that he probably wasn't allowed to shoot. As he said in interviews, he was told by Warner Brothers not to be shooting extra footage, just to be assembling what he already had. But he's gone against that and done it off his own back. And we get some great scenes there, obviously, with particularly at the end, with setting up the whole Batman and Joker alliance, if you like, folks, against the invasion of Earth. Now, people are clamoring together under the Restore the Snyderverse hashtag. And this is great. I'm even doing it too, folks, because I really want to see this director's vision. He's given us some amazing films. 300 really got the ball rolling for me. Really enjoying his stuff. Dawn of the Dead, but also Watchmen. Really over my eyes that this guy's got something to say. You know, it's different from the original works, and it's certainly different than what we've had before. But what he has to say is interesting. He's an artist, and he certainly doesn't compromise his own vision for the sake of others. The only other difference he would have made was give Henry Cavill a mullet in this. Now, folks, there's not one podcast would be behind that more than us here at Lethal Mullet. Folks, we want the mullet cut. Restore the mullet cut to to that amazing film. It's great. And, of course, there's going to be some twists with Superman. Superman joining, obviously, the people from Apocalypse. Darkseid and his minions. And it's just, yeah, it's great, folks. We want to see it. And, obviously, with the Suicide Squad now on the way, James Gunn, which is kind of a reboot slash sequel, or as I like to call them, requel, which we've had a few of, folks. We've had the second Ghost Rider movie that was like that. We also had, what was it, Wrath of the Titans, which was kind of a sequel slash reboot, so a requel. And so some of them being successful, some not, pretty much using the available people from the first films. And we've got that here. Viola Davis is back. We've got, obviously, Idris now coming in. We've got John Cena as the Peacemaker, which looks a lot of fun. But why isn't he carrying a 45 Peacemaker? He's carrying some Desert Eagle knockoff-looking thing with a huge barrel. You know, any gun nut in his own line will say, if your name's the Peacemaker, you should be carrying the weapon of the same choice. Choice and name, that is. But, of course, this is going to be interesting. But I think this is the big reason that... you know, Warner Brothers themselves are not interested in seeing an Ayer cut. So that is David Ayer, who did the original Suicide Squad, just called Suicide Squad. He's mentioned a number of times that that thing was hacked to pieces by Warner Brothers editorial and stuff like that to get the movie out there. So there's another cut. It's different. And he's himself said that. I like him as a filmmaker. I think he's a fantastic filmmaker. If you guys haven't seen the Arnold film Sabotage, go and check it out. It's great. Obviously, he's written some stuff too that is just amazing, and you know what they are. Obviously, just an amazing director. And again, somebody that I think really is a straight shooter when it comes to his vision on screen. So that's happening out there, folks. So release the AR cut is the other hashtag. Brilliant, isn't it?
Please hang up and try again.
Now it's time for the Lethal Mullet Cafe, as we chill back, relax, and look at the trivia. All the detail, the nitty-gritty of the films we are celebrating. All right, folks, we usually put the cafe at the end, but we're putting it up front, folks, because we want to spend a bit of time getting to know this film. It's been quite a while for me. I haven't seen it was the second film I saw on VHS many years ago, and I actually thought it was the first, so to go back down memory lane is really good news. It's a 1983 film, and obviously a 1989 one for the sequels. We're talking about, of course, Eddie and the Cruisers. Now, this is a series of films which really are a nice dive back into, and we'll say a flashback to a time where rock and roll was kicking in, and also a time where in the 1980s, people were looking back to that rock and roll time. It's kind of a look back retro-wise, you know, people looking at the Beatles and... Rolling Stones, many other bands at the time. Even in the 2000s, another 20 years later, people are also looking back to the 60s. It's always been a fun time for musicians and just music lovers to check it out. So the first film was an American film, drama, and it's a musical as well, directed by Martin Davidson and with a screenplay written by himself and also Arlene Davidson. It's also based on... It's also based on the novel by P.F. Klug. So there's also a bit of obviously a story with that too, the fact that it's an adaptation of the material as well, which is just great. Something I want to check out now is the novel series as well. So looking at the production itself, the music was done by John Cafferty and his band, cinematography by Fred Murphy. It was... brought together with a production company of Aurora Productions and distributed by Embassy. Now, this was released all the way back in 1983, September 23. And I tell you what, after watching it, folks, it doesn't look that early. It feels like the film was made in the later 80s. That's how far ahead is a piece of music. When it comes to, well, the music itself, the movie itself too has that feel of a late 80s film, not an early one. So it's a bit of a groundbreaker, I think. Even though the film wasn't a huge success, it did make most of its money back. With a budget of $5 million, at the box office it made $4.7 million back, which is really, really interesting. Now, the cornerstone of this story is about, of course, Eddie Wilson, a rock star that was legendary in the 1960s with a band that just kept taking off in the clubs, and they had one song that was just really starting to break in through all the radio stations and obviously the clubs and stuff like that. And it was a real balls-to-the-wall hard rock band called the Eddie and the Cruisers. Now, as it opens, we see, obviously, Eddie Wilson and his band in a club. And you get this great the rock ballad playing, and it's their big hit. Now, what's great about it is the music seems timeless. If anything, it feels like an 80s rock ballad. But, of course, it's 20 years earlier, in 1963, when we see this flashback for the first time. And this is getting to, for us as a viewer, a window into the world, see what Eddie Wilson was like. Because then we jump forward, obviously, to a recording studio where we see a journalist by the name of Maggie Foley, who's trying to investigate the disappearance of Eddie Wilson, who's believed to be dead after riding his Cadillac off a pier. There's been no word since, and so all assumed he was dead after this event happened. The band itself kept going into all their different careers that they had, but out of that too, there was one member who kept it going to some of the clubs with different singers and stuff like that, which is part of the actual story itself. The other part is also Frank Ridgway, a.k.a. the Word Man, played by Tom Berenger, who is a high school teacher at the start of the film when we see him in the 1980s. But he was an element in the band that shot them through to success with amazing lyrics. Not a natural musician, but one that could really put an amazing word with everything. Of course, called Word Man by Eddie Wilson himself too. And I think there was a real kinship between the characters as they met each other. Obviously, we see a flashback to the 1960s where Frank Ridgway is holding court in at a local pub. The band comes in and says they're here to play. And, of course, he has his chance to have a say about how a song should go after they've jammed it. And, of course, they bring in classic bits of how music's made. Things like leaving some silence between parts. And, of course, it's the genius of that that gets him a gig as the keyboardist in the band as well. And obviously you get the band manager, Doc Robbins, Sal Alamato, the bassist, and, of course, the saxophonist, Wendell Newton, and Eddie's girlfriend, Joan Colino, who's also the backup singer. And, of course, Kenny Hopkins, the drummer. And they're played extremely well. We'll get into that cast very, very soon because it's an amazing cast. So Tender Years is their first album. But part of the story here is about them getting their second one together, which is called A Season in Hell. And, of course, it really is a nightmare for all of them because they're trying to make the perfect album. Eddie beats himself up relentlessly. Michael Parry doing an amazing job as a musician that's really trying to find himself through all his insecurities and really putting forth performance that's far better than people give him credit for. It is an amazing performance of a rock star who really is in touch with his musical side, I think, but he's trying to find his voice, and he does on this album, even though the producers of the album have no idea what to do with it and basically say, we can't use this, we can't put it out, which is part of the reason that we see that Eddie takes off. What's great about it too is through all the flashbacks we see what brought about the events and what supposedly happened to Eddie as he obviously went off the cliff, or in this case, went off the pier and Could have drowned. We don't know. There was nobody ever found. So, as the reporter, Maggie Foley, and, of course, Tom Berenger's character, try and track down the rest of the band in the 1980s, we get to start to see some of the events that happened. And, obviously, too, we start to find that even they've asked questions as to whether Eddie's still alive. That's the crux of this film, folks, and that's the mystery of it's what makes it so amazing. And, of course, the film generated some great material when it comes to the music, which we'll go on to too very, very soon. So Frank Ridgway in this first film is actually the lead, played by Tom Berenger, and Tom's really, really good. He's very young in this. Obviously, he's probably very, very early on in his career, but Tom really plays somebody who's, I think, wanting to have been a bigger part, even though he was a huge part of the band, but was coming to terms with the fact that he was a bit ostracized by Eddie. Michael Paré, as mentioned, Eddie Wilson, fantastic in it, and really does a great job in all parts where he's trying to really get this band to come along as a machine together. Joe Pants is in this, folks. That's right, Joe Pants. And Joe Pantoliano plays Doc Robbins in this. And I almost didn't realize it was him. You know, I'm looking at him, I think, this can't be Joe Pantoliano. But no, folks, it is a very young Joe Pantoliano. He plays, obviously, Doc Robbins, who's kind of a scheming band leader who's trying to make a buck. But at the same time, the big recordings of Season in Hell is what they're all trying to find. But after, of course, Eddie's gone over the pier, those recordings mysteriously disappeared. Interesting. Matthew Lawrence plays Sal Amato. And Sal is great. He's kind of like the guy that just wants to keep going with the band, even though he knows without Eddie it's not the same. So he's the heart and soul of the band, but also a friend, a real friend to Eddie. Helen Schneider plays Joan Colino, the girlfriend of Eddie. And she's great in both time periods, really keeps up the mystery. Obviously, she has, I think a real interesting role in the fact that she's kind of getting to know Tom as, obviously he's Frank Ridgway, closer and closer as we go through the film. And to some degree, Eddie's obviously quite, annoyed with that as well. We've got Michael Tunes and Tunes as Wendell Newton, as the saxophone player. And then we've got a very young Ellen Barkin as Maggie Foley. She's very good in this, actually. Quite good. Now, the music supervisor of the film, Kenny Vance, appears as Lou Eisen, the 1964 record company producer or slash executive, I suppose. And he's the one that is in the scene where they say, look, we're not taking a season in hell. So that's a real guy. But what's interesting about it is I think the band itself actually feels like a band. You know, obviously it's not the music that the actual band is playing from. You know, that's coming from John Cafferty and the band as well as obviously Kenny Vance. And, wow, amazing material. But I think the cast really gels because it looks like one of those bands that's just been around too long together, folks, you know. And anyone that's been in a band knows that there's trouble and there's also creative tension, and this film really, really elaborates that quite well.
Alrighty, mate.
Time to go down to the pub for a pint, a chat, action movies and more, here on the Lethal Mullet Podcast. Alright, folks, we're going to talk about the production itself. So Martin Davidson, who created the film itself, said that the inspiration was to get his feelings about all the last 30 years of music into one project. And of course, obviously, after he optioned P.F. Kluge's novel at his own financial risk, so he put it all together by himself, he put the actual screenplay together, and at the end of the day, tried to get it out there, get the deal made. And he made a deal with Time Life, who was going into movie business itself at the time. Obviously, went in film at that time. Now, he went through quite a big risk in trying to find somebody that wanted to make it, but it wasn't until he got with Aurora Productions, They finally gave him a $6 million budget to put it together. So obviously, you know, it's one of those projects that's obviously a passion project, and one that definitely has, I think, a love of music about it. Martin obviously has a passion for the sonics of music, and you can tell this is a story about finding the ultimate song, the ultimate track, the ultimate piece of music, which we're seeing through Eddie Wilson in this as well. So that's what makes it so interesting. Now, to get the band together, what they decided to do, Davidson hired Kenny Vance, who was part of Jay and the Americans, so one of the original founding members of it, to put the music together, find some way of getting this group of actors to look credible on screen as a band, as Eddie and the Cruisers. So what's interesting about is they got stories from Vance. They got obviously Vance then bringing in too a band to play the music. So, you know, they put everything together, but until you actually had a soundtrack, they obviously didn't have music as its core. This was more about teaching the band itself. So teaching Michael to play guitar, obviously, and Tom to play keyboards, and Sal obviously playing bass, so Matthew Lawrence. And each of them went out and basically tried to learn it. Michael Paré at the time was a chef in New York. And again, he sort of got plucked out of obscurity and put into this. Even though he'd been on TV with some TV roles like Greatest American Hero, he's in that. And other different roles as well. So they were playing, and obviously the great thing about it is that they got, before the film got together, they started to look credible as a band. And of course, that's one of the huge things, is that as Michael Paré, himself, he really looks the part. He looks like a rocker, and he also has that sort of almost jaded quality of being out there for too long trying to find the right tune, trying to find the right sound. Ellen Barkin obviously played a very short sort of a role in this as Maggie Foley, and wasn't too happy about being in the production by the sound of it. Didn't like the script, and from all reports, hated the production. But again, we've got Davidson creating this great legacy. He's a bit of a legend to the character of Eddie Wilson in the fictional universe of Eddie and the Cruisers. But what's great about it too is you ask questions, is Eddie still alive? And we find out just at the end, as Eddie and the Cruisers is playing on TV, we see an older Eddie Wilson looking back through to the TV screens with a beard and leather jacket, and yeah, folks, he's still there. Which, of course, is going to greenlight the sequel, because you need Eddie to be even part of that. I think very much the sequel is the Eddie and the Cruisers, because it's not only a comeback for him playing, a character that's obviously been out of the world for a while, for 20 years, under a different name, but at the same time, he's wanting to come back and regain what he'd lost. And of course, particularly when they're trying to produce the album that they said they didn't want. So Vance asked Davidson to, give him the idea of what the sound was going to be like. And what's great about it is that he then gave a bit of a sense of the different styles of music that were out there. And so Vance then found John Cafferty in the Beaver Brown Band, and they're from Providence in Rhode Island. And the music, which if you look it up, folks, look up John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band on YouTube, you can actually see a lot of these songs played on video with a live band there. And it's brilliant. It's amazing. And you can see why they were chosen for the band, because it has everything out there that is done in the film. How Eddie introduces each of the members of the band. That's what John does in some of those videos as well. So the great thing about it is too, just the way that that came together. And obviously you can see them play the hit On the Dark Side, which is of course Eddie's hit in the films. But it's a great, amazing one. And of course, Tender Years was another single that came off that one. And again, it's just such a great album. I've got an LP, folks, luckily. Never seen it on a soundtrack out here in Australia, and it's just amazing to have. So, folks, if you haven't, you've got to check it out. It's worth it. It is well over a 5 out of 5 on the Hallenbach scale. All right, Mr. Mullet, where was this film made? Where can we see the locations of this film? I'm ready to jump on a plane and see these locations. All right, folks, as asked and as we are now on each episode, we're going to be looking at some of the locations of each of these films that we do. And, of course, Eddie and the Cruisers, really, really interesting locations, particularly some that are based around New Jersey, which are just absolutely gorgeous. But at the same time, look like any other city to some, New Jersey has a particular look, and that's what I find interesting about it. So let's look at some of the locations. We've got Tony's Mart, Summers Point, New Jersey. We've got also Mount Holly, New Jersey. But the big one that I like this is the Castle Junkyard site at 382 Jackson Road, Atco, in New Jersey as well. Now that's an interesting one too. It's kind of like where we see Michael Paré's Eddie Wilson trying to find himself in amongst all of this amazing celebrity that's starting to kick in for him. Also, they go to Glendora, Ocean City, and Summers Point again, Highlands, and they also go to Atlantic City. So maybe if some of our US listeners can tell us about some of those locations. But obviously, the film set basically around Pennsylvania, New Jersey, USA as well. Obviously, an amazing set of locations when you look at just how much was shot on this film too. There's also Haverford College, which is at 370 Lancaster Avenue, Haverford, Pennsylvania, as well, which we see at the start of the film where Frank Ridgway is teaching a class before he gets plucked away to look after and find all the rest of the band, Eddie Wilson as well, if he can find him. And that makes it all the more interesting as we start to track down parts of the band too. So, interesting points, but I think one of the things too is about this, New Jersey itself is a character in the movie, and I think it's a perfect location for Eddie and the Cruisers. All right, folks, you're here. You want to find out about what happened to Eddie Wilson? Well, now we're going to tell you, folks. I hope you're ready. And here comes the band, Eddie and the Cruisers 2. Eddie Lives! All right, folks, let's talk quickly about the sequel. So, the sequel really is about Eddie Wilson. I think the first film is more about finding the legend, really finding the feeling of what the band was. It was more about the band than it was about Eddie Wilson itself. But in this, it's all about Michael Paré, folks. It really puts him to the front. Tom Berenger's not in this one. This is more about the character itself. As the actor plays Eddie Wilson in hiding, where he's a construction worker in Montreal, Canada, and he joins a local band, and he turns out to be, of course, the long-lost New Jersey rock legend Eddie Wilson, who mysteriously disappeared. That's right, disappeared after an accident. Returning as Eddie Wilson is, of course, Michael Paré. We have Marina Orsini as Diane Armani, who plays love interest in it. We have Bernie Colson as Rick Diesel, the rockin' character, this young upstart rock star who's kind of like a young Eddie, if you like. We also have Matthew Lawrence returning as Sal, Michael Rhodes as Dave Pageant. We have Anthony Sherwood playing Hilton Overstreet and a number of other amazing actors. We have cameos of Bo Diddley and Larry King and... Hey, folks, this is actually quite a good film. I've enjoyed both, but I think Eddie and the Cruisers 2 gets a bit more of the rock and roll vibe right. Whereas I think the first film strives more to be about the legend of a rock star and looking up old friends, all that sort of stuff. So the film, obviously, with this, the characters come forward from obviously the book originally. The director on this one was Jean-Claude Lord. The film itself, I think it's pretty straightforward return to form of Eddie himself. What's great about this one is that we get to see some great scenes where Eddie finally accepts that he has to put the past behind him and take up the mantle and have a second chance at getting the music out there. And it's a great second chance. If anything, for some of us that are in our 40s now, having almost a second crack at a career, this is what this film is kind of about. Having a second chance at being successful. And Eddie's at a point where he is being this, Montreal worker, where he's willing to give all that away. He's willing to not take the chance of getting any better. And as we see him at the start, he doesn't look anything like his rock star self. He's got a mustache, a little bit longer hair. Doesn't look the part that he was. And it's not until he finally has a shave and starts doing his hair like he used to in the 60s and meets Sal on the beach. And it's a heartbreaking but also heartwarming scene where Sal's like, where the hell have you been for 20 years? And it's like old friends reuniting, and it's a love-hate thing. But at the end of the day, the friendship and the love of the friendship comes through, and it's such a beautiful scene. And also, it's about him being kind of a mentor to these new rockers. And as we find out, Hilton, for example, knew the whole time that he was Eddie the minute he started playing. He even says that you can hide your name, but you can't hide who you are. You can't hide being the player that you are, the talent that you are. And, of course, this is what drives him to finally get out there as Eddie himself. And we don't get it till right at the end, folks, right at the end of the film, where he finally gets out to talk about the new band. And like he did with his other band, he goes around and introduces each of those people. And when he gets to the end, he says, "And I am Eddie Wilson." And they rock out the classic songs. It's amazing. It's great. It's a great set of films. If you're going to watch it, you've got to watch them together. They really are well worth putting together. They both get a 5 out of 5 on the Hallenbach scale, folks. That's how good these movies are. G'day, folks. Hope you're enjoying the great shows here on the Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to check out all the great shows that we have on offer and subscribe on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. You can check Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Rysel and Lee Fillingsis on their platform. You can also check out Culture Clash, which is the weekly look at pop culture hosted by Kevin and Kyle. Couch Potato Theatre, this is a cult classics and guilty pleasure podcast. Also Time Warp, a fandom flashback show. End Zone, a look at the NFL, the American football. Also Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, looking at the great films of Alfred Hitchcock. Union Federation podcast, a Star Trek and Orville podcast, looking at Discovery, and of course Picard, plus the Orville. Also the Hair Metal podcast, looking at the great shows put on by the amazing bands back in the late 80s, their discs, their LPs, everything, all covering the fashion as well, hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Rysel. You can also check out Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, hosted by Kevin and Dan Hadley, looking at all the eras of Doctor Who. You can also catch out What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, an amazing show looking at Star Wars, hosted by Derek and Scott. And of course, our newest one, the amazing The Mullet Guild, an offshoot of the Lethal Mullet podcast looking at Frank Herbert's Dune universe. This is like an encyclopedia for Dune, where I take you through and down into the rabbit hole of Frank Herbert's amazing space opera, the sprawling universe which is going to be brought to life by Denis Villeneuve and December 18. You can check out all the shows there. Be sure to also go onto the social platforms on Twitter at FanPod Network. Let us know what you think of the shows and what else you can look at there. You can also check out great articles that we put up through there that we share. Also check out on Instagram and Facebook, Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to make sure that every Tuesday you check out the great work done by Making Treks as well. A brand new podcast looking at a deep dive of Star Trek, hosted by myself, James Semple, and of course, the ever popular and amazing writer of Star Trek and Star Wars, Mark Newbold. Go and check it out, folks, and we'll catch you next time here on the Phantom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet Podcast. Good afternoon, good evening, and good